How you doing? It's Keith Tomasek, and you're listening to The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. On today's show, actor Neil Barkley. Neil's been a regular at the Shaw Festival for over 20 years. We talk about that coming right up. Yeah, Neil and I have known each other longer than that, actually. We've known each other since college, although we haven't kept in friend, you know, we haven't kept in touch like we're best friends or anything. We first crossed paths at John Abbott College in Montreal. Neil was studying the basic program there and took a theater class as an elective, and I did the professional theater program. Ironically, Neil is now a professional actor, and I am not. How things change over time, eh? Hey, I have to say thanks to my sponsor, Karen Hartwick, over at Stratford Tea Leaves. If you love tea as much as I do, you'll love Stratford Tea Leaves. And you don't have to be in Stratford to experience the fantastic teas. You can just go online. Visit StratfordTeaLeaves.com. And or you can give her a call, Karen Hartwick. Her phone number is at StratfordTeaLeaves.com. And I got to tell you, she's offered a great deal to listeners of the show. You know, I do this show out of the, you know, my basement, the suburban basement spare room. And it does cost a little bit, this beautiful recorder I have. Karen's sponsorship helped to pay for that. But if you're interested in helping supporting the show, just visit theinadequatelife.com. You can throw a couple of loonies in the old hat there. Or if you want to give $30 or more, you'll get a special package of tea and some Inadequate Life stickers for the kids, you know? Anyway, so thanks, Karen. Thank you very much for supporting us at StratfordTeaLeaves.com. If you want to support us, visit TheInadequateLife.com and check out, just support the show. So, an actor, the life of an actor. And really, this episode is all about, it's more about life than it's about the creative process. Remember, the title of the show is a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. Well, the big word there is life, right? And here's what's going on in my life right now, because it's cold and I'm living in a 20-year-old house that Susie and I bought a couple of years ago. The furnace is dying. 2 years ago, the air conditioning died. As I said, oh no, it's going to be one of those episodes. As I said, we're tight. So we're like, yeah, we can live without air conditioning for a little while. And then last winter, her furnace was making so much noise every time it turned on. I'm like, please don't die. Please don't die. And here we are. It's been running so far, so good, knock wood. But it is scary every time the heat has to come on. We're going to make it. So, you know, I'm looking at $8,000 to fix that. And the heat exchange is also 20 years old, and that's kind of black inside. I don't think the air going around my house should be going through a box that's black. So I have to replace that. All that to say, Neil has a very different lifestyle. He's not a homeowner. And I've only very recently been a homeowner, but he has the luxury of, when he's not at the Shaw Festival, of traveling and seeing all different parts of the world. So we talk about that and the impact that's had on his life. And we talk about a little bit about growing up as an only child. You know, Susie and I have Cole. We're not having another one. And both of us come from larger families. So it's a bit, it's always interesting to hear from someone who grew up as an only child and what that was like. So there you go. Thanks again for listening. I appreciate you taking the time. And here comes the interview with Neil Barkley.
I almost saw Chicago in Tromsø, Norway, which is about 400 kilometers north of the Arctic Circle.
What were you doing up there?
I was there to see the film festival. Zev Asher had told me about it, the Tromsø International Film Festival, which is also called TIFF. And it's the world's northernmost film festival. And because I was seeing, I think I saw 10 movies over 3 days, I didn't have time to see Chicago, but the posters were all over town.
Wow. Was it, I guess, a domestic company or some sort of touring show?
It was, it may have been like a tour through Scandinavia. I don't know if they do different languages. It's funny, Tromsø is actually quite a nice, it's a university town. So even though it's so far north, there's lots of culture, and they have this great film festival.
Well, that's, you know, when I lived in Winnipeg, I found that there was a lot of culture there. Not that it's so far north, but almost because you can't go in away. Like, I'm in London now, and when I moved here, I thought, oh, it's a small town. I live in small towns, I'll be fine. Mm-hmm. But I live in a small town really close to a good big town. London's actually really good. Well, the Grand Theater, you were in Alpha, the Grand Theater. Mm-hmm. And how was it playing that theater? Because it's a very historical theater.
I love working on a stage where Jessica Tandy worked, and I love working in a theater that's where she's the, her name is on the rehearsal hall.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And it's amazingly intimate. When I saw you in Elf, which you were great, by the way, very, very.
Thank you.
Very funny as Santa Claus and very sort of commandeering and dangerous as the bad boss. I forget his name.
Mr. Greenway.
Mr. Greenway, Greenway Press. I was sitting, we probably were in the eighth or ninth row, Cole and I, and I'll never forget the moment when I turned around to look behind me as I started to leave the place, and there weren't that many rows back, and I realized this seems like a really intimate, I've never been on the stage, but it seems like it would feel like quite an intimate house. Is that true?
It is. It's unusual. I don't know the specific numbers, but I knew that the orchestra is actually smaller than the balcony, and that it's probably about a third to two-thirds
that makes
divide.
Sense.
And so, yeah, I'd noticed the same thing about the orchestra, how small it seems. The balcony is significant.
Yeah, I know. It's a gorgeous theater, and it was a great production. So let's, before we go to Shaw, let's talk about how we met, because it's I'm an old man. It's a long time ago. I was studying theater at John Abbott College in Montreal, which is where I grew up, and there was a thing there called, there was two things. There was a professional theater program, mm-hmm. which was a three-year program geared for people who wanted to come out and be professional actors. Which I enrolled in, and I think they took me on a whim because I hadn't done any acting really before that. I was sort of a comedy magic kid, and I used to do magic shows at birthday parties and all that. And I was upstage at Yuck Yucks, and so they saw something in me. I had a presence. And then there was also the theater workshop, which was it was a non-specific program. So you could be taking social sciences or health sciences, and you could also enroll in theater workshop. And that's what you were doing. So we kind of crossed paths then.
Yeah. I suppose I didn't really know for certain what I wanted to do when I left high school. And in Quebec, you leave high school, I guess, a year earlier than you
Ontario.
Do in Ontario.
Yeah.
So,
like 16 or something, 16 or 17.
Yeah, so I was still pretty young. And I'd done two plays in high school and had, you know, gotten positive feedback for them. But it was still not something that I was 100% sure of. So theater workshop seemed like a nice compromise. I had no idea when I signed up for it how much work it would be. It was on the schedule. I think it was maybe 6 hours a week. But, I mean, in reality, it was probably closer to 30. And you know, we were there late at night.
And they
rehearsing.
Were great, great productions. It was a beautiful, the Casgrain Theater was a beautiful theater. And we had great, you know, Jean-Claude Olivier, who was doing stuff mm-hmm. at NTS. And some of the other people in the technical side were also working at NTS. And I mean, it was I think it had a good reputation, would you say?
Yeah, and I think I can't speak for the period before or after me, but I know the group of people who were in theater workshop when I was there, a number of whom have stayed in the business. Kaz Anvar, who I did a couple of shows with, he's in Los Angeles now. He's been on 24 and Lost, and he just played Dodi Al-Fayed in the movie about Diana, which I didn't see.
Oh, yeah,
the
I haven't
one with
seen
Naomi
either.
Watts. Yeah. And Matt Holland, who he does a lot of writing now, but we were all in Toad of Toad Hall together.
I remember that. Yes. Yeah, that's hilarious. Wow.
And the fourth person in that, first it was Al Ghulam, who still acts a lot, and then Winston Spear took over the part while we were in rehearsal.
Did he do theater workshop?
He did, yeah.
So Winston is a comedian. I tried to get him on the podcast just a little while ago and missed an opportunity, but sure, he's well known for his dancing. He does this really weird dancing thing. He does great comedy.
He does, yeah.
But he has an amazing physicality, and he's a great story about that. It was at Abbott. He took a dance class. I took a rock climbing class at John Abbott. This was Quebec, right? For the people who don't know. You know, Quebec in the 70s or whenever it was, maybe the early 80s or mid 80s. Like, I took a rock climbing class. I took a cross, you know, you could do things. I remember there was one teacher who had at part of his final exam was the students had to chain themselves up to a piece of sculpture. Do you remember
really?
That guy? Yeah,
it
was like leftover drug culture. Vietnam,
yeah, there was a lot of that. Yeah,
Vietnam sort of draft dodging guys. Anyway, now I've just scummed out to school. I don't mean to do that.
I took a great class, and I have to say that as much as I say theater workshop demanded a lot of work, I also took a class where the entire course load was reading one book and writing one paper. And I got the same credit for that course as I got for theater workshop, which was like
hundreds of hours of work.
But.
And I met, you know who I met there was Kevin Tierney, who's a great producer and writer now, and his son Jacob is super active. But the funny thing is I was in the professional stream. I got kicked out after 2 years, you know, because I am who I am. And I don't remember anybody in my group that is actually, you just named off three people who are doing it well. Do you know anyone in the professional theater program that came out and is still acting? I can't think of anyone off the top of my head. Anique Mattern is still around.
I was going to say Anique. I saw her in a commercial the other day.
Yeah, she's still around. She was in my year. She made it to the third year.
Well, there might be something that we didn't have the pressure that you guys might have felt. I mean, that we were going into it a little more casually.
Yeah. So yeah.
And I got to say that Murray Napier and Ian Smith, who ran the program, were terrific teachers.
Oh, yeah.
They were just really nurturing and had a great sense of fun and play. And we love doing it. And some of my best friends still are people that I met
in that period,
in that course.
And I remember Ian Smith was my first introduction to, he was our, what is the term, chorus master or, you know, choral director? Or?
Yeah, he was, I mean, he was a co-director, but if there was music in the show, he was the music director.
I'll never forget. So I'm a kid, you know, and I'm sitting in the with a group, we're doing our rehearsals, and it was our first or second day, and, you know, he's this white-haired, not severe-looking guy, but an interesting-looking guy.
Yeah, he was acid.
Okay.
Yeah. I would say he was sharp-tongued.
Very sharp, beautifully, though. And
oh, yes.
So I remember he's sitting, and he asks some woman to hit a note, and she goes, ah! And he goes, young lady, you're much too crotch conscious. Please untangle your legs. Let it flow. And I'm like, wow, this is cool. I love that.
He loves sexual metaphors.
I don't remember. I remember that one. That's
singing teachers tend to. It's not uncommon, but
that's
he certainly enjoyed shocking us all. And I went to private Catholic school, so I was easily shocked at that time.
I ended up. His advice to me in terms of singing, because I was in the chorus for No No Nanette, was to not sing. So I literally moved my lips because I really can't carry a tune. I respect him for that, though. He just gave up on me. Well, that's fine. We're on the same page. Anyway, so you got out of there. You got out of Abbott. So we were young. I mean, I was young. I remember, I got kicked out. That was kind of hard, getting kicked out. You know, I was into second year, and then some of the professors decided, one professor particularly decided he didn't want me. He was going to be the interim teacher in year three.
Oh, yeah.
And then I went and complained to my improv professor, who was great and loved me and loved the work I did. And he was like, oh, this guy didn't tell us he was going to kick you out. And then the movement teacher. So they said, oh, we'll rally for you if you want. And I'm like, what am I going to want to go back? And he was the third year director. He was directing the company show. I'm like, I'm not going to want to put myself in a position of having a deal. So I left after 2 years, and then what did I do? Well, I guess I worked. I did comedy and magic a little bit before I went to university. But you so got out of CEGEP, so you did a two-year thing, right?
Yeah, but sometimes, I mean, people who, you know, they form theater companies out of people who got kicked out of the state schools. I know the Odin Theater in Denmark, which I worked with one of the directors while I was at theater school, and that company was completely formed by people who had been kicked out of the Danish National Theater School, and they formed their own company, and then you look at art, I mean, the Salon des Refusés in the 19th century are all the people who couldn't get into the regular exhibits, and they're the ones who went on to become the great. So
anti-establishment, the greatest things are done in defiance of management.
Yeah. And I know, like, I went to National Theater School after John Abbott, but I've met so many great actors in Canada over the years who have their stories about their auditions for NTS. And
I can't imagine.
Never made it in.
So you graduate from Abbott in beautiful Santa Ana de Bellevue in whatever it was, May, June. And did you have your, so you came in, what did your parents think? So you go into that CEGEP not knowing if you're going to be interested in acting, and you come out and you knew you wanted to be an actor.
Yeah, I left theater school. The daughter of Murray Napier, Carla Napier, who was doing a production of Three Penny Opera with a company in Montreal called the Association of Producing Artists, she suggested I audition for that. So even before I went to theater school, I did my first professional show, which was Three Penny in French and English in Montreal.
Very cool. So then you, after that May, you went to NTS right away?
And I went to NTS in September.
So was it a good experience for you the whole time?
Yeah.
There?
I mean, theater school is always going to have ups and downs. We did have a collective nervous breakdown after our clown project in second year, though.
Why? What happened?
It went really poorly. We were not, I would say, overall. I shouldn't speak for my other classmates. I personally was not found. Clown was not my strength.
Not your thing. Yeah.
And the way the presentation had been set up, we were all together in this one big classroom, and it was kind of like a clown fair. And so the spectators had to choose
move
who they
around.
Were going to watch.
Yeah.
And inevitably, some people had all the spectators, other people had none. So we were all really depressed at the end of that.
That's
period.
A life lesson right there.
I know. It was, but that was, I guess that was kind of Lord of the Flies. But we said we have to get out of the city, so we rented a van and drove to PEI.
Oh my! As a group of students. Oh,
there were a couple of us demurred, and they stayed behind. But I think there were like 12 of us. Yeah.
Wow.
And one of our classmates was from PEI.
How fun is that?
It was great.
Yeah.
It was a real bonding experience for us, and still the only time I've been to PEI.
That's really cool. No, that's one of the few provinces I've never been to. So then you get out. So you're on path. Your mom's probably happy.
Yeah, very.
You know, your life's going all right. I'm in theater. That's pretty cool, right? And then there's that dreaded, okay, now I get out. I'm going to have to be a waiter. I'll have to have a... I mean, I've talked to quite a few folks on their show. Actually, Shalina Kennedy didn't have a civilian job. I remember talking to her about that. She kind of started working right away. But Chris Abram, the director, for 8-10 years, he was doing all kinds of different things. How was your path when you got out?
Well, I was lucky in that after first year at NTS, Guy Sprung, who was then running Toronto Free Theatre, came up to the school to audition all the students to come and do the Dream in High Park in Toronto. Mm. And myself and there were about 5 of us, I think, who he asked to come down and do the show. And it was an as cast deal. Like, we didn't know who we were going to be playing. And we knew there was a 2-week workshop in fencing and Shakespearean language and stuff that we do before that, sort of academic.
It's a good gig. Guy Sprung and some nice training.
Yeah, and I'd been to Toronto only once or twice before.
Did you grow up with that Montreal, I hate Toronto thing?
I suppose so. And my dad, I remember when I was a kid, was almost transferred to Toronto, and that was like a big cloud. No one wanted to go. But then I guess one of my best friends from high school went to Arendelle, and so I started coming down to visit him and starting seeing Toronto theater. So I had a taste for it.
So no real, nothing? No waiting tables, anything like that?
Oh, well, yes. Then things went downhill the next summer.
Then things went downhill.
Yes, because I had no theater work after my second year. And I did some telephone sales, some, you know, that kind of call center stuff, which was really soul destroying, selling magazines
in Toronto. Montreal. Yeah, there's a lot of that in Montreal.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of illicit stuff. You know, Kelly Nestruck from the Globe and Mail on the podcast talked about how he was involved in one of those illicit places for a while.
I may have been as well. I don't know. Maybe I didn't stick with them long enough to neither know they were illicit.
Yeah.
They were depressing. And then I worked as a busboy at the Barbie Barn, which is a legendary rib
on Guy
house
Street.
On Guy Street. And my job was, in addition to dishwashing, was carrying about 6 big things of ribs.
Racks, those big racks.
And they cooked
ribs
them in the basement, and it was like a 6-story restaurant.
A small, tall, thin place.
And I was going up a fire escape at the back of the
restaurant.
The ribs? It was a rainy week, so I was having to avoid slipping and also avoid burning my hands on the hot containers of ribs. And I lasted, like I say, 2-3
days. Lots of fun. Did you get gross? They're very sweet, the ribs there. They're huge. The people go from all over.
I've never been a rib fan.
Okay.
And I didn't even eat them when they were offered to me for free. I had the chicken.
So tell me about at Shaw, what have been some of the roles that you've enjoyed doing the most or that you found? You stood out in My Fair Lady doing Alfred Doolittle.
Yeah. It's a funny part because you feel a little guilty sometimes because he's only on stage for about 20 minutes in total. Everyone else in the show is on stage through the whole thing. And I'd be sitting in the cafeteria by myself, you know, sort of reading.
No, that's really not fun.
Playing Words with Friends, and everyone's glaring at me, you know. And then you come on and you have these 2 great songs. And, you know, on a good day, the audience really loves you. And so it came with a lot of guilt.
That's a sweet gig, though. I had no idea.
It is. Apparently Stanley Holloway, who did the original production, was very frustrated by the short stage time.
If that's your summer, that would drive you nuts.
Yeah, so he used to go and look at... I think he would go in and like look at other plays on Broadway while he was doing it, and then he'd look at his watch and get back for the second act.
Jeez. But
that was great fun. And in fact, I was supposed to do that play in high school, and our drama club decided My Fair Lady was too expensive, and they canceled it.
Hmm.
So that was a early disappointment in my career, so I was able to over that emotionally
carry
and psychologically.
That with you, right?
Yeah.
And then anything else at Shaw that you enjoyed doing?
Well, after the dance, that play by Radigan that I mentioned, this beautiful play that I love Terence Radigan's plays, but I didn't know that one when I was asked to do it. And sometimes when you are given a play and said, you know, we'd like you to play this part, you sort of are not able to enjoy the play necessarily because you're reading it so much through your own role. But in this case, I just devoured the play, and I love my part, but I love the play. And we were all kind of proud that we did it when no one else had seen it in years. And then a year later, the National Theatre in London did it to great acclaim, and it went on to win all the Olivier Awards that year.
Tell me, was there anything specific with that character from After the Dance that you loved and related to in terms of what made it special for you?
Well, he's described in the play as being a sort of parasitical hanger-on to this couple. He's a...
It's not such a good idea,
but it was, and I think it was somewhat in jest. One of the characters describes him like that. I never had any danger of viewing him that way. I loved him right from the beginning. He's the best friend to the main couple in the play, and they've known each other since they were, 20 years old, and they were three of the kind of survivors of that era in England, known as the Bright Young Things, when. Was one of the kind of first examples, I guess, of a real hedonistic time in London in the 20s. And the play takes place in 1939. And they were the generation who were too young to go into the First World War, and they're too old to be going into the Second World War. But the war is looming, certainly. Sure. And they're all waking up after like a collective 15-year hangover and facing middle age. And some of them are doing it better than others. And
your character?
Well, I think he could go both ways. He's certainly still indulging, but I think the kind of dust is coming out of his eyes, and he's seeing the dangers of living that kind of life too long.
Yeah.
And the main character doesn't, and he's the one who's still kind of devoted to it. And so my character became the kind of moral conscience of the play.
And is that something you relate to personally as an outsider watching what's going on around you?
Yeah, I think I do that. And I think that playwrights and writers who exist somewhat outside the box are ones that I've been drawn to unwittingly. Sondheim in musical theater, always, I think describes himself as someone who tends to be an observer.
Yeah.
Alan Bennett, the British playwright, constantly says, that he's always felt outside the swim a little bit.
So do you feel like that personally? Well, a little bit.
I think so. Like, I mean, not to an obsessive degree, but certainly when I played that part, I realized, oh yeah, this is very much you. You know, I felt very at home in that aspect of it.
And then, any sense of where that comes from in your own personal life?
Well, I'm an only child,
sure,
and I've never had brothers and sisters, and I think the theater has provided often. A family,
yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And I've really enjoyed doing plays where I'm part of a family.
Yeah.
I think about like You Can't Take It With You, where
sure.
even though I wasn't a blood member of that family, I played the Russian choreographer Kalenkov. But that whole play is about not just a born family, but an acquired family.
Right. Yeah.
I always remember the end of Mary Tyler Moore show. Always struck me, even as a kid, when she talks about family and saying that. That these people that she's worked with the last seven years are as much family as.
Yeah.
And so theater is good for that.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that your dad passed away when you were young.
He did, yeah, when I was 15. Yes.
Wow. What happened? You mind what happened?
No, he was, he was not well. He had a heart attack and he died. It wasn't a complete surprise.
Right.
He had lost his own father when he was around the same age.
Oh, my gosh.
His father had been a coal miner and I think had died of black lung. But my dad was the oldest of nine children, so he actually had to go out to work and
support. There's a history there
of early demise.
Yes,
but then on the other side, I look to my mom's side.
Oh, that's
good. They all lived
into their 90s. I can see some optimism in your eyes there.
Yes.
Yeah, that's good.
So, and in fact, apart from my dad and his father, no one else died quite that young in the family. So.
Huh. And do you remember, I'm sorry, I'm going to don't mean to dwell on this, but do you remember what that was like when you were that young, having your father pass away?
It was kind of surreal. I mean, again, like I slightly stood outside it, I suppose.
That makes sense.
I remember just being told that I was the man of the family and that I'd have to,
By your mom or by someone around you?
By my mother, by everyone else.
Yeah, that's a weird pressure to put on a kid.
But even at the time, I just kept thinking, well, no, that's not what's going to happen. So I don't think I felt a pressure.
That's kind of horrible. So someone slaps you on the back at the funeral. I guess you're going to be the man of the family.
Oh, yeah,
now.
That happened too.
Yeah.
To me a lot at that time.
Yeah. But. Did you cry? Did you cry?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I just remember, I just asked because a friend of mine, she was telling me when her father died and she didn't cry. I've lost touch with her, but she was profoundly disturbed by the death as much as she was by the fact that she wasn't able to process it emotionally.
Huh? I suppose I was as I think I was probably as much concerned for my mother.
Sure.
And witnessing her sadness and her grief.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Was probably as troubling to me. I mean, because to be honest, my dad and I had a fractious relationship, I'd say.
That happens when you're 15-year-old. Well, I mean, that's my greatest fear. I've got a 7-year-old. He loves me. Well, he's starting to turn. So I'm like, I might be done in 3 years completely, you know?
I'm sorry he didn't hang around longer because I'd be curious to know how it would have evolved over.
And it does. Of course it does.
Adulthood.
Because then you manage. That's what I did with my father. I mean, we had that sort of fractious, horrible relationship, partly in Montreal around the time I was at Abbott when you knew me. I mean, I don't think he ever came to see a play there. I know he didn't. My mom did. But then you get to that point in your adult life when you somehow learn, okay, I need to manage that relationship now.
Yeah.
I need to be the one in charge. And you kind of, some people do, and even in my family, we all have very different relationships with our parents. And your mom, is she okay still?
She passed away now 9 years ago.
Wow.
But she lived into almost 80. So, yeah. But she was... we had our ups and downs.
Sure, yeah.
But generally a pretty
But super supportive of the theater, though.
Oh, yeah, always. Yeah. I think she... also, she was an only child as well.
Oh, wow.
And I think that she probably appreciated, although we never talked about it, the fact that the theater does provide a family, especially when you work in one place for a long time.
Well, it's a concern. So my son, Cole, Susie and I, you know, he's an only child. We started too late. We can't have another one. You know, and we're happy with the way it all worked out, but... I think about that sometimes because I came from, you know, there's four of us in my family, and Susie's got a large family. And you wonder, when both of us are passed, you think about that. What am I going to leave my child with? So that must have been something that I'm just thinking about that now as you, yeah.
I think that the only real, I don't want to say it's resentment, but I did feel when my mom was dying that I thought I'd really love someone else, not necessarily to do work or to have someone to talk to about it.
Yeah,
who was and I was lucky. I had lots of cousins and friends, but there's always something about a sibling. I think that's more intimate than
I mean, so. Last year my mother almost died. At this time, she's fine now. She recovered, but we were in the hospital room as a family, which brings. I'm just trying to imagine you at that point in the hospital room alone, or were there close people with you?
I almost always had someone around, and there were, you know, both my friends and my mom's friends.
Which is good, though, because you're not fighting with them, which is what happens when you get four siblings and there's a parent dying. That's what happens,
because
every kid knows a different parent, because we all grew up, we were far apart. So there's all these, I mean, one of the members of my family shows up from out of town with a huge bottle of vodka and two bottles of wine. He's staying for 3 days. I'm like, what are you thinking? Not my thing, but you know, we all do what we do, right? But it's hard. So that's interesting. So that's the fate that I will bestow upon, or we will bestow upon Cole, because he'll be an only child too.
I think it's certainly more common in general in the theater. It's very common, I think, to have only children because actresses tend to, I think, wait longer than they used to.
Oh, for sure, right?
So until their careers are kind of taking off. And there, just in the Shaw Festival Company alone, there are a number of only children of company members.
Wow. So here's a question, though, talking about theater that I'm always intrigued by with the companies, so Shaw and Stratford. What's it like in terms of security? Because, you know, in my world, people assume because I'm working at the university, I have a secure job. But in fact, I'm a contract worker, and I'm really, you know, every year or 2 years, depending on what kind of contract, I have to sort of beg and hope that I get, you know, the graces bestowed upon me once again. How is it for actors in a company at Safe Shaw, where you are?
Well, I don't know whether anywhere in the world now has anything like tenure.
Sure. No,
I know in Europe, the old companies, you know, the state companies did used to be tenured companies, I think, where, you know, people would join them as young actors and be with them their whole lives.
So here's how I feel. When it's coming up in my last third of my contract, I feel, have you seen Moneyball?
Yeah.
I feel like the character, I forget his name, the coach character.
Yeah, Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, thanks. Who doesn't obey the manager's rules because he says, look, I'm coaching so I can explain on my next job what I was doing. That's what I'm doing. So after a certain point, I kind of feel like that, which is not a great feeling to have. Do you find that goes on in theater as well? To work? Because you're going to be thinking, am I back? Am I not back? Do you have to audition to come back? Or what's the process?
The Shaw Festival has generally been a... not as audition-centric as some companies. occasionally, I mean, one year I was asked to go in and sing for the lead role in a musical. And that was mainly because they had not heard me
sing
a part like that, and he wanted to hear me. And that happens occasionally. But generally, I haven't had to do that in my time at
Shaw.
That's
great.
Which is nice. But it also means my audition skills may have atrophied.
That's, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
You know, I don't think I'm a great auditioner.
Yeah.
Well, and some people are. Some people can go in and knock it out of the park.
Right.
And can't always do it then when they get in the rehearsal hall. But.
And how is the cycle of the season? When do you start? When do people start thinking about, like I said, you know, 4 or 5 months before my contract is up, I'm thinking, oh, should I be looking for work? Should I be publishing something different? What do I need to do to lock in for next year? Does that happen with the actors?
Well, we kind of have, I think, an unofficial sort of code that we don't start thinking about next season until at least opening night of the first year.
That's awful.
Sometimes people break that rule. But
wow! So the show hasn't even opened in your East.
Yeah, Well, you know, I mean, not. I wouldn't say really worrying about it, but at least
thinking,
speculating.
Yeah.
Do you know what like shows are going to be done next year?
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
that kind of talk. It's a fruitful area of discussion for company people.
And then you're signed up. And then do you live in St. Catharines or Niagara on the Lake?
No, I've never lived in Niagara on the Lake. I come from a long line of renters,
sure,
being from Montreal, which
I'm
was a big renting
yeah,
city.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of renting.
And then my dad grew up in council housing in Scotland.
Huh.
And so I've always been a little afraid of buying anything. And certainly there was an unspoken rule that, you know, as soon as an actor bought a house in Stratford or Shaw, that would be the year where they wouldn't get an offer the next year. So
Does that happen?
Well, it happens sometimes. You know, there are a lot of people who've proven it wrong. But I because of my natural disposition not to want to own a house, I've never bought or set or put down roots in Niagara on the Lake. I generally leave within a few hours of the final curtain. Literally, I sometimes have a taxi waiting to take me out. Not that it's not a lovely town, but So I mean, Toronto has always been my.
Oh, you're
base
so close, of course.
Operations.
So much going on there. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when I moved from Montreal, I just assumed that I'd be working in Toronto,
right?
And so I've always thought of that sort of as my base, but in the end, I didn't end up working as much in Toronto.
So that's got to be odd. And when you're at the Shaw Festival, so you get a home in Niagara on the Lake during the summer.
We rent from the festival.
Oh, okay. And then do you keep a place elsewhere? I guess it depends on the year sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it varies. But that's, I mean, I'm almost always have an apartment in Toronto that I can go to.
Do you feel like you're living out of a suitcase?
Somewhat. I mean, I also travel a lot,
right,
too. And my tendency, as long as I know that I've got a contract coming up, I often don't search out work in the winter.
Sure.
I travel. So, I mean, literally, I do live out of a suitcase some winters.
Yeah.
You know,
but that's great, though, because you have the freedom to just go anywhere you want. And during that period of time, you have a bit of freedom and you're loose enough to be able to just get up and go.
Yeah.
Favorite places to go?
Prague was definitely one of them. I've been going to Argentina a lot.
Really?
I spent a lot of time in Buenos Aires the last few years.
We got to talk. That's when my wife wants me to take her for her birthday that's coming up.
Yeah. It's a good town. Yeah, it's a very good town.
And what drew you to Argentina?
My friend Patty Jameson, her cousin went. and she said, Carl came back and loved Buenos Aires. And she went down and spent time with him there. And so she said, next winter, we should go to Buenos Aires. And for about 4 or 5 years, I rented an apartment in Buenos Aires and had friends come down. There were like 7 of us once in the apartment. And
wow, that's so cool.
Yeah. Well, it was, I mean, especially 10 years ago, it was so cheap.
Right.
And you could live so well.
Yeah. And good wine.
Good wine, good food.
Yeah.
Beautiful architecture, crumbling, but beautiful.
Sure.
Not a completely perfect society, but.
That is really, and where else? So Buenos Aires, that sounds like fun.
I mean, another city I love is Rio. I've only been there a couple of times, but I loved Rio when I went. I love Scandinavia.
Hmm.
That has the opposite problem, of course. It's so expensive.
Sure, to get there. Yeah,
to get there. And then to like Norway is just absurd.
The cost of living. Eh?
Yeah, but it's so beautiful. And because I tend to travel in the winter, I think Scandinavia is a great place to go in the winter because it's so pretty.
So to turn it around, do people come visit you in St. Catharines?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, no, I have a pretty active little B&B going, and Not literally.
Yeah, yeah, but to return the favor.
They get one B, generally, not two B.
That's funny. The bed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And is there something you'd like to be in that you haven't, that you think, or a role on something you'd like to be in that you haven't?
I'd love to do a little more Shaw, because even though I've been there now 25 years, I haven't done tons of Shaw plays.
Okay.
Yeah. And I they're really challenging, and there's so many good parts for, you know, men in their 40s and 50s in his place.
Right. And is there any in terms of career path, what do you see for the future? You want to keep, is there a period where you'd like to retire, or you just sort of think?
No, I have no desire to retire. Actors rarely retire. They keep going as long as someone's pushing them out on stage and they can more or less remember their lines.
Yeah.
So I'd like to...
More or less remember their lines.
You know, so... So yeah, I'd love to keep going until I can no longer function.
Anyone whose career you sort of see in that regard that you can sort of go and...
Well, there was an actor at Shaw for many, many years named Al Kozlik, who I think is the epitome of a company man, who played some leading roles, but usually supporting parts. And that's kind of what I've done. Yeah. You know, like every couple of years you play a really great, great part, but... usually it's really good supporting parts. And he was a lover of theater. He was so innocent in that way, and wide-eyed about the stuff he saw and the stuff he was doing.
Which is, that's an amazingly beautiful quality to have of your own craft and profession at that point in your life.
He was in his mid-70s, and I never heard Al say a cynical word about anyone. I'd lost that by the time I was 30. and Al was just an absolute exemplar of that. And in England, there was an actor named Michael Bryant at the National Theatre who was the same kind of actor, you know, just a wonderful actor, and kept going. And both of them, coincidentally, their last role was Fears, the butler in The Cherry Orchard.
Oh,
I was lucky to be in the production at Shaw with Al. And I saw, unfortunately, after Michael Bryant had left, the one in England.
Yeah.
So maybe that's a good role to go out on.
So he decided to retire?
Al had decided to retire. He had been talking about it for a while.
Because you mentioned that a lot of times actors, they'll either stay on as long as they can or they'll just stop getting work, as opposed to making a decision to retire.
Well, I think he had begun to feel like he was maybe, not at the place where he wanted to be, not as sharp as he had been. Yeah. And so he had been talking about it. And then when Fears came up, he said, well, I'd love to play that part and it would be a great part to go out on. And so we had the rare treat of being able to have a retirement party for him.
And
to say, thank you for all these years you've given us and all the memories. And that was a beautiful thing.
I bet, yeah.
Yeah, if there's a career I'd love to model myself on, it'd be Al's.
Don't take that role, though. That's the thing.
Well, I'll wait. If I'm 80 or, 85, then I'll feel, if this is it, that's fine.
Well, Neil, that was really cool. Lots of fun. We'll have to meet in Buenos Aires.
Yeah.
If not on stage, right in St. Catharines at some point.
Yeah, happily. Yeah. I hope so.
All right. Thanks for doing this.
Okay. It's been a pleasure, Keith. Good seeing you.
Yeah, good seeing you. Well, there you go. What a voice Neil has. Isn't that an amazing voice? You could just listen to him talk about pretty much anything. Anyway, thanks so much to Neil Barclay. He's overseas now, traveling around, seeing shows, eating fine food, and enjoying himself. If you're interested in heading out to the Shaw Festival, if you're a member, you can purchase tickets right now. Of course, membership has its privileges. But the Shaw Festival box office opens to regular folks like you and me on January 7th. So January 7th, you can visit the Shaw Festival online and pick up some tickets for the upcoming season. Hey, and if you like the Shaw Festival, you probably like the Stratford Festival. Ideally, you visited one of my sites, Shaw Festival Reviews, or Stratford Festival Reviews. If you're thinking of heading out to Stratford, I highly suggest a place to stay called Avery's Inn Next Door. Take a look up online or take a look on TripAdvisor. Avery's Inn Next Door. Susie and I spent a couple of days there last summer, and it's a wonderful. It's not a bed and breakfast, but it's like a bed and breakfast. The owners of Avery's Inn, which is one of the most historic and beautiful bed and breakfasts in Stratford, opened a place next door which has all the charm and sort of spirit of a bed and breakfast, but It's private luxury suites, so there's no breakfast. You don't have to deal with that sort of stuff. The inn is right, 5 minutes from the Festival Theater, 5 minutes from the Avon Theater. It's a beautiful location. The folks who run it are really cool. As I said, check out Avery's Inn or Avery's Inn Next Door on TripAdvisor or their own website. And they book up fast. It's a great place to stay, and they do book up fast. So if you're interested, you might want to lock something in now. Anyway, that's it. Thanks again for listening to The Inadequate Life. I hope you get a little bit of creative inspiration every week. Don't hesitate to drop me a line on the website, theinadequatelife.com. Contact us, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of The Inadequate Life.